Gavel, so I called to order the meeting of the UTEMCO Board of Directors. The date is September 11th, 2017, and the time is now, looks like 10:02. So before we start, I'd like to recognize our three newest directors, Janet Hanley, Rad Weaver, and Robert Gant. Everybody, let's give them a hand. Now, as you know, this is an unpaid, there's no compensation, but we do have a very nice piece set of cufflinks. Janet, I'm not sure you'd want them, but
there you go.
We've come up with a new tradition.
Thank you. All right. Robert, you'll use the cufflinks.
I mean, like our collection, I you just went up about 10.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Rad, finally, you. Anyway, you guys want to get a give a brief introduction? One minute or less. How's that?
Great. Thanks, Jeff. Robert Gant from Houston. It's good to be back in Austin. Have been married 30 years, three boys. They're all three in Austin. Oldest is in the MBA school. Middle one's looking for a job, so if anybody's hiring. And then my youngest is a freshman at UT as well, so we're excited to be here. I'm one of the founding partners of Avalon Advisors in Houston, and very honored and humbled to be a part of this team. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Robert. Rad?
Sure. So Rad Weaver from San Antonio. We're married 14 years, and we have two young kids, 11 and 5. Been spending some time here in Austin with a couple of volunteer jobs, so excited about getting this one kicked off. I'm CEO of McCombs Partners in San Antonio.
And Rad also serves on the UT Board of Regents. Did you say that?
Okay. No,
all right.
Hey. Volunteer position.
Cool.
Janet.
And good morning. I'm Janet Hanley. I'm from College Station and A&M class of 76. A little bit ahead of my fellow Aggie over here, Mr. Rothrock. And up until December 31st, 2016, I spent the last 16 years at the Texas A&M Foundation running their investment office. Ray was one of my investment committee chairmen for 4 years, if I recall. And very honored to be here.
Right. Thank you. Well, I know speaking as the chair of UTEMCO and as the vice chair of the UT Board of Regents, we are just really excited that you guys are all on board. I think this is a new era with UTEMCO. Certainly we have a new CEO, CIO, who you'll meet in a moment. But I want to thank you in advance for your service. And what I love so much is you guys are, you know, you went to A&M, University of Texas grads. I mean, this is all about creating, I think, a passionate board that goes the extra mile, that puts the extra work in just because they're in love with the mission and they have a long-term view of how to make both A&M and UT great institutions. So I couldn't be more excited that you guys are on board. So thank you so much for your service. Okay, I'd also like to welcome Britt Harris to his first meeting of the UTEMCO board. We are excited you're here and look forward to many years of great returns. Thank you, Britt. I have a set of couplings for you. Yours is a paid job.
Thank you. I'll still take the couplings.
So thank you, and we'll hear more from Britt in a moment. Additionally, I'd like to recognize and thank Mark Warner for his dedication and service to UTEMCO during this interim period. Thank you, Mark. We have a formal resolution for Mark that I'll present in a moment, but I'd also like to present both Brent and Mark with these cufflinks as tokens of appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, next we will take up the resolutions of appreciation that are in tab 2. There are three resolutions for appreciation. One is for Mark Warner, one is for David Beck, and one is for Lee Hobson. If all directors could sign the three resolutions that are in the receptionist area before they leave today, we'll send them to be framed. I'll read the resolution for Mark, and really they are very much similar. So They're all applicable for Mark and David and Lee, but commend you to read the other two resolutions of the board materials. Whereas due to his substantial background and expertise in business and global investing, Mark Warner, Senior Managing Director, Natural Resources and Emerging Markets, was appointed as the Interim Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer of the University of Texas, Texas A&M Investment Management Company. With all the powers and duties of the Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer of the corporation for the investment of the funds under the fiduciary care of the Board of Regents of the University of Texas System, for the benefit of the University of Texas System, the Texas A&M University System, and the citizens of the state of Texas. I'm going to hyphenate this, and I'm going to say, be it resolved that the directors of the University of Texas, Texas A&M Investment Management Company do hereby express to Mark Warner, Lee Hobson, and David Beck their sincerest appreciation for all of their leadership, commitment, and service to UTEMCO. Thank you very much. So may I have a motion to approve the resolutions of appreciation for Mark Warner, David Beck, and Lee Hobson?
I move.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Resolutions are approved. Tab 1, there are no action items in this section. Let's move on to the approval of the minutes of the July 25th, 2017 meeting. Are there any comments or changes to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
For a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Minutes are approved. The next item relates to corporate resolutions for the election of UTEMCO officers and new committee assignments. We will take each resolution separately. The first resolution lists the individuals who are being appointed to the office or offices next to their name. You have a copy of the resolution in your materials. You will notice blanks next to the offices of chairman, vice chairman, and vice chairman for policy. I nominate Ray Rothrock as vice chairman and Steve Hicks as vice chairman for policy. May I have nominations for the office of chairman?
I would nominate Jeff Hildebrand to be chairman.
Second.
Is there any discussion? You sure? Okay. If not, may I have a motion to approve the resolution?
So motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
The resolution is approved. Thank you very much. The second resolution relates to committee assignments. You may recall we approved the members of the Audit and Ethics Committee at our last meeting. Today we will make assignments for the Compensation, Risk, and Policy Committees. I nominate the following individuals to the Compensation Committee: Ray Rothrock, Kyle Bass, Robert Gant, and Ray Nixon, and designate Ray Rothrock to serve as the chairman of the committee. I nominate the following individuals to the Risk Committee: Kyle Bass, Robert Gant, Ray Rothrock, and Rad Weaver, and designate Kyle Bass to serve as the chairman of the committee. I nominate the following individuals to the Policy Committee: Steve Hicks, Phil Adams, Ray Nixon, and Janet Hanley, and designate Steve Hicks to serve as the chairman of the committee. May I have a motion?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Resolution is approved. Next, Britt will present the UTEMCO performance report and market update. Britt, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me, before I begin, just say what a privilege it is to be a part of this organization, representing the University of Texas, Texas A&M, MD Anderson. It's a special honor for me to be here. That's number one. Number two is I want to thank both the board and all of the people at UTEMCO who received me so graciously and so well. And with such support. It's been 5 weeks, but everybody has really been terrific. I just want you to know that I'm grateful for it. All right, so we've got Greg Jensen over there. Later on, he's going to take you far into the future. But let me, sort of the first page here, I just want to set a framework. And Phil, you're going to have to have eyes in the back of your head. So here's the way that I believe markets function. And before I get into it, one of the main points of this is that traditional diversification doesn't work. And the reason traditional diversification doesn't work is because you need diversification to work at the right time, not just on average. And so the way the market is set up is this blue zone that's in there are, you know, conditions that support equity markets. And every decision that is made, every decision that you make, that I make, that the board makes, that your family makes, that the state makes, that corporations make, every healthy person in the world who's making decisions, whether they know it or don't know it, are really through the wisdom of crowds trying to get us into what I call this blue zone here. When GDP growth is fine, inflation is okay, you know, when you have that earnings growth will be decent, you're not going to have a lot of political instability during that period of time, and frankly, valuations are not going to matter that much. And so everything we do in the world is meant to get us into that zone. When you're in that zone, believe it or not, equity markets historically have produced returns of about 15%. So whether you go to UT or A&M or any other school, you're always taught, you know, equities earn, you know, 7 to 10% type numbers. And as Ray knows, they never earn 7 to 10%. You know, they earn a lot more or a lot less. When you're in the blue zone, you typically earn about 15% on your equity investments. And so in that area, Utemco has 65% of their current assets. There's it's a very defensive implementation of that equity zone because of the high hedge fund exposure that's in there. But that's the blue zone. When you have that framework, then it makes it simple. Like, what could go wrong? You know, what could cause economic activity, you know, to go in some other direction? And so if you go into the green area, moving to the left, it means your economic activity is not sufficiently high. It's usually because demand is falling, and so inflation is plummeting. Earnings are normally plummeting at the same time. You tend to get some political instability when that's occurring, and all of a sudden valuations matter a lot. And we have 11% of the portfolio in that area, and frankly, you know, and you'll see this in the very end of the slide, if we go out of the equity zone, this fund definitely wants to move to the right and not to the left. You know, there's not much disinflationary hedge, you know, in what we have in this portfolio right now. The other direction, the real return zone, is when economic activity on a nominal basis is fine, but on a real basis is too low because inflation is rising, and all of a sudden you have equity returns dropped about 6%. I forgot to mention in the green zone over there, equity returns on that side, you know, will be significantly negative. So just think about this as a piston. When that blue zone shoots down, you know, you need a hedge on one side or the other, depending on which way it went, that's going to symmetrically rise. So on the right-hand side, you know, we have a large energy and natural resources portfolio. Real estate is known as an inflationary hedge that can depend kind of on what the circumstances actually are, and we have commodities in that area. So this is how the world sort of sets itself up. Now, if you're looking at the next slide, you got to remember those colors. Remember, the blue zone was the equity zone. I got to orange this a little bit. So we have these charts for every major country, and the blue zone is what the consensus believes about what's going to happen, where economic activity currently is. And it's a very simple chart. You know, along the bottom axis is GDP growth, on the vertical axis is CPI. And so long as you stay in that blue zone, the odds that equities are going to outperform bonds are relatively high. If you move into the purple zone at the top, that's when you're getting to a real return area. The green zone is Death Valley. Box number 7 is where we were, you know, in the great financial crisis when we had, you know, really low CPI and really low GDP growth. And essentially since, you know, this is what I've been kidding our chairman about. He's kind of like, he wants these great returns in the future. You know, we are 8.5 years into an economic expansion, and the U.S. stock market has tripled during this period of time. And the U.S. stock market has been in this blue zone every single moment of that time. Now, there's a bunch of numbers on this page, so I'm going to try to help you with some backdrop here. The way to read this chart is the yellow area is, you know, we live in the United States, and the first thing is, you know, we do not have to diversify outside of public markets, outside of this country, into alternative investments. But we do, and I'm in favor of that, and I just want to show you sort of how things have worked out. So here, the first thing, if you look in the one-year number, one-year comp, the last year financial markets has been terrific. But before we get into that, for stocks, before we get into that, I want you to notice the CPI number at 160 and the cash number at 49 basis points. We've been, during this entire period, we've been living under what's called financial repression. Now, financial repression is when the Federal Reserve puts the interest rate below the inflation rate in order to essentially force money, you know, out into the economy. And that has been successful. I believe, you know, everybody has their own opinion about how the Federal Reserve has behaved and how effective they've been. I personally think they've done a terrific job during this period of time. We were on the verge of a depression, you know, at the beginning of this period. And so the Federal Reserve has kept us in financial repression until this day, and we'll be in financial repression for a while. If you look at I'm still in the one-year column, you look at the long Treasury bond for the last 12 months is down 7%, but that all occurred in 1 month, the month that Donald Trump was elected. But if you look to the left, you know, on a year-to-date basis, rates have gone down again. So that's the top part. The U.S. stock market over the last 12 months has been up 18%, whether you're looking at small-cap stocks or large-cap stocks, so a terrific return. But if you look into the purple area, where now you're seeing diversification beyond the U.S. public markets, for the first time in a while, you're having markets outside of the United States perform better than markets inside the United States. So developed markets, meaning Europe and Japan principally, are up 20%. A lot of that has been the euro and emerging markets for the first time in quite a while have been outperforming. Now, this is all through June. Going down, hedge funds have been up 6%, real estate 7%, and commodities have been the outlier in terms of negative returns. So that's just the one-year number, and I just want to set that up because then you look over at the 10-year number. Now, this 10-year number, you have to remember, includes a year and a half of the Great Financial Recession and then 8.5 years of, frankly, pretty fantastic returns. If you look at the S&P 500, you know, the S&P 500 is back into, after all this time it's been, you know, we're in the American empire, the S&P has led, and so U.S. stocks are up about 7%, these are indices numbers, private markets are up 9%, so therefore the risk premiums that you're, you know, expecting have sort of normalized. But looking at the non-U.S. markets, on a 10-year basis, the non-U.S. markets are still only up 1%. So as you go forward, none of this stuff is gospel. This is all probability. Going forward, to think that you could have another 10 years of 1% type returns outside of the U.S. would be catastrophic. During this period of time, point to point, hedge funds have been disappointing. Commodities have been disappointing. I just point out the 5-year number for real estate. Real estate came off the bottom and has performed well. So those are the returns. Looking at risk in this one particular way, in terms of standard deviation, the only point that I want to make, and Greg will make this point again probably, is that volatility that's in the markets today is at all-time lows. So if you look there at the S&P, on a 10-year basis, the S&P is 17%, which is relatively normal. For the last year, it's been 6%. So volatility, and then you look at, you have that same low volatility in every single market. You know, EFA at 20, that's 7. Emerging markets at 18, it's at 9. Hedge funds, 7 at 1. Commodities, you know, normally 24 at 7. So we're at an all-time low in terms of volatility. Now, so we're 8.5 years into this expansion. The return for this fund over the last 8.5 years is 10.5% per year. And the fund has gone from $8 billion, I'm talking the PUF, has gone from $8 billion to $19 billion, you know, during that period of time. And we've all forgot about this part. You know, there will come a day when there will be drawdowns, and we'll talk about that towards the at the end of this presentation in the risk section. And when these drawdowns occur, these are the types of numbers that we probably will see. So one of the things you have to do is be prepared for this. These are peak to trough numbers. We're talking about 50% declines, you know, in the peak to trough number. and this is when everybody's metal will be tested. During that period of time, hedge funds will, I would expect our hedge funds to be down about maybe a little bit less than half of that number. But if the stock market peak to trough goes down by 50%, hedge funds will go down, just not by as much. And commodities also go down. Now, it'll be interesting to see that the saving grace and diversification going backwards has been long treasury bonds. That has been the one massive diversifier. You see that here in this particular category. You know, a negative correlation with, so you see there, long bonds have been up 7% a year, basically the same as stocks, but they've had a negative correlation to stocks during that period of time. Some of us are old enough to remember a time when that was not the case. So that has really been, long treasury bonds have really been pretty much the only place to get true diversification during this particular advance. And honestly, during the 8.5 years, you didn't really need a lot of diversification. Other areas of diversification have been tips, oil, and gold. So then finally, Sharpe ratio, and this is a little bit on the academic side, but let me just, so this is a Nobel, this is the E equals MC squared of finance. It's named after a guy named Bill Sharpe. This is a Nobel Prize winning formula. And basically what it says, the way to interpret this is that all markets, at the end of the day, will have a Sharpe ratio of around 0.3. And Sharpe ratio is the asset return of, of the market minus the risk-free rate divided by the volatility. So it standardizes all asset classes. At the end of the day, they're supposed to have an information ratio of about 0.3. So what I want you to notice is, again, the S&P is right there at 0.3. So it has gotten back to normal. But international markets are not back to normal. Hedge funds are not back to normal. Certainly commodities are not back to normal. So that's the frame of reference just for the sort of the returns that we are about to look at.
Britt, let me ask you a question. So in light of what you just put on the board, what is your thought about cash in light of it's never really been used much by institutions as a way to diversify and reduce the risk? Yet from history it shows it clearly does.
It does. It's very difficult. The most important quote to me from a book that was written in the 40s is a book called Where are the Customer's Yachts? And in there, he said, look, I can tell you how to make a fortune. Hold up conservative stocks, conservative bonds. When conservative stocks do really well, sell your conservative stocks, buy conservative bonds. Then this is an important part. He says, inevitably, you'll be wrong for 3 years. But eventually, the day of doom will arise. Your conservative stocks will do very poorly. Conservative bonds will do very well. When that happens, do the reverse. And eventually, the sun will rise, and you'll make a lot of money. At the end of it, though, he said, I've never known anyone who could follow this strategy. So the use of cash, there will be, when the time comes, I have a feeling that cash may be the diversifying asset because of some of the things that I just talked about. Commodities may also be a diversifying asset. We'll have to see. But the point is, you better be prepared to stay in that position for quite a long time. Now, we do have enough time horizon to do that. But I'll show you a part towards the end, which is called panic attacks. And there have been 57 panic attacks during this where the stock market went down 5 or 10%. People who use those panic attacks just to get more defensive. So it's a tough one. Jenna.
Sure, who's calling in? Can we get some resolution?
Might at least answer.
It's going to be a short board meeting.
Maybe that's the way to do it.
I'll just bowl through.
Bowl through it. Yep. All right. Okay.
All right. So here's just an overview of the funds. The endowment funds are now at almost $29 billion. The operating funds are $11.6 billion. So the total assets that you oversee through us is $40.4 billion. Just point out that 2 years ago, that number was $35 billion. So in the last 2 years, about $5 billion has been made in this system So clearly it's been a very good 2 years. For this particular year, the PUF was up 13.4. The longer-term funds were up 13.6. And the ITF was up 8.01. Remember, the difference between the endowment funds and the ITF is principally that the ITF does not have private equity in it. The alphas are very strong on a one-year basis, over 400 basis points for the endowment assets and 258 basis points for the intermediate term fund. The if you look at that, now I was talking about these downside, you know, moments. When you see a chart like this, now all, you know, all everybody at this table was around in 2007, 2008, and some previous one. You know, that was a pretty horrendous time. The fund dropped to $8 billion. And since that time, it's recovered to $19 billion. That's, you know, this is a long game, and you basically get tested during these down market periods. With regard to competitive rank, for the last year, the fund is in the top 25% of all portfolios. So 25% for all funds, 26th percentile for funds over a billion, second quartile for endowment and foundations over a billion. Longer-term relative results not as high. The principal reason for that is this has been a more conservative portfolio than other portfolios during this period of time. You know, the simplest explanation is we've had a 10% higher weight in hedge funds, which have, you know, been up 5 or 6%, and 10-point underweight in private equity, which has been up about 16%. So there's a 10-point swing there, you know, and about 100 basis points is where we are with relative to other funds on a longer-term basis.
Congratulations on your one-year numbers.
Thank you. You know, I can't take any credit for it at all.
You can't get an attaboy for top quartile. This is a tough crowd.
It is a tough crowd. The Jeff told me it was going to be a tough crowd before I came in. And obviously that's due to this.
Actually, we go back real quick.
I don't know if I can or not.
We have the technology.
Well, this is going to screw us up. How do we go back?
Second from the top.
Previous. There you go. So EF greater than a billion versus all greater than a billion. What's the distinction between those two?
Say that again.
Others would include pension funds.
So the last two, yeah. So all includes all. It's pension funds, whether private or public, and obviously lots more of those. And then the 53 just includes the endowments that are over $1 billion. And this all comes from a group called Trust Universe Comparison Service, which is kind of the industry standard for trust results.
So further to Ray's comments, so opine on that. What do you give us from a report card standpoint?
You know, I just think you have to recognize that you were running during this period of time a more conservative portfolio than your peers, which is number one. Mm-hmm. When you look at the, the first big difference in any two funds is what's their asset allocation, and so we had much more. We had a 10% higher exposure to hedge funds, which earned, around 5%, and we had a 10% lower exposure to private equity, which earned around 15%. So that is really 90% of the story. Now, at the same time, you're looking at numbers here, 5 and 7 years, 8% type numbers, with inflation being under 2. During all these periods of time, the investment team here outperformed their own benchmarks. So it wasn't an implementation problem. It was mostly just a mismatch between asset allocation. And that's not a good or a bad thing per se. It just is what it was. If we make 8% over the next 5 years, we're probably going to be in the top 10%, of all funds. And if inflation stays below 2, we're sitting here and it's still at a 5% real rate of return, which is more than sufficient to fund what we needed.
What I find interesting is, for those of us that have been around a while, we've never seen this information before,
right?
In terms of where we rank. And I think if we'd known some of this, we may have made some modifications sooner than we did.
Another thing to keep in mind, that middle column, mm-hmm. which includes pension funds in general are going to have a very different looking portfolio than the ENFs. They're going to have a lot more long bond exposure because they're matching liabilities.
Right.
And long bonds during this period generally did really well. So if you look at those 7 and 10-year numbers, you actually look worse there than in the far right column. Mm-hmm. And that's probably mostly because of that long bond exposure.
No, and Mark, I know you did quite an extensive amount of work. The team did. And what was the final conclusion? Is the underperformance over kind of the 7 and the 10-year period, on a percentage basis, how much was it due to the policy versus the
Well, the simplest way to answer that was all due to policy because we outperformed the policy.
It was all due to policy.
Well, we outperformed the policy by an average of 150 bits.
Okay.
So if you'll remember, Steve, a little bit different than your comment, we did a really detailed analysis versus our peers. We looked at our asset allocation and walked everybody through that. Uzi did a ton of work on that. And it was Brits captured 80% of the delta, which was we were 30% hedge funds, our peers were 20. We were 25% private equity, our peers were closer to 40 or 45. So, and you know, the other big driver was we're about half what most endowments, the top 20 endowments, which is what we've always comped ourselves versus, we have about half as much venture during the period where venture worked.
Mm-hmm.
So on a 10-year basis, those things all, I mean, Uzi, you can remember the numbers probably. We broke it down by asset class and looked at each one and how much did over or underweights to each asset class hurt us. The other thing that hurt us was we were heavy into commodity futures, and commodity futures over the past 5 years have been the single worst performing asset class. So just that allocation, now that's almost zero now. But on a backward-looking perspective, that costs us, you know, I think 50 or 75 basis points versus our peers.
The point I was making, I just never saw it in numerical numbers to how we rated in the 76th percentile versus our peers. I know we're obviously we're different, but this is very eye-opening to me.
Well, and let's focus on the 1 year. You know, so things have looked good in the past year, both in terms of returns and in terms of rank. And I also want to point that 4.9% 10-year number, if the markets hold out for another 1.5 years, that number is going to jump way up.
Britt, do you think the size of our fund is limiting in terms of the performance relative to the universe we're comparing against?
No, that may be because I'm coming from a $140 billion fund.
Well, that's why I asked.
Yeah, obviously there are.
That has been proposed before.
Yeah, there are obviously niche areas, you know, where it could be a slightly limiting, but I don't see anything that we're doing right now that has a huge limitation because of the size that we have. All right, so here is the 1 year results. And this is called a Brentson analysis. And so let me just kind of break this down for you. So in the left-hand column, you see the asset allocation of the fund. And when you're seeing equity, that means all public and private equity. So the way you're used to seeing is at the bottom, MCC, LCC, private. This is, and you still have those numbers, but at the top, this is all public and private equity. And so for this period of time, on average, the developed equity portfolio has been 4.1% underweight, slight overweight in emerging markets. That has been offset by an overweight to natural resources and fixed income. And that's been the principal position at the top line level for the fund over the course of the last year. If you move into the middle, you see the returns themselves versus the benchmark. So every return for UTEMCO for this past year has been double digits, except for fixed income. So 15.6% for total equity, 12.7% for fixed income credit, 14% for natural resources, 12% for real estate, 13.4% for the whole fund. Then you see the benchmarks, and then you see the alpha in each asset class, positive alpha in every asset class except for emerging markets, and really significant alpha. When you're looking at, and we're going to highlight, I'm going to let Susan and Mark to talk a little bit about the main contributors here, but the big contributors in terms of the outra, both returns and alpha attribution were developed equity and natural resources. So Susan, she should be here somewhere. I haven't seen her. Right behind. Where is she? Oh, there she is. So if you look at the next chart, I just asked Susan if she would just kind of walk you through the developed equity results.
You guys have
Oh, sorry. Yes. Right there.
So there's four boxes here. If you look at the top right box, it summarizes the economic environment today, which is basically what economists are calling synchronized global expansion. The dark blue boxes on the top are the number of industrial economies experiencing positive real GDP growth, and the light blue boxes on the bottom are industrial economies experiencing negative real GDP growth. So you can see that for the first time since the 2000s, nearly all industrial economies are growing. The bottom right box summarizes the global earnings environment at the company level. The white line is earnings estimates for the MSCI All Country Global Index, which is about 90% jobs and 10% emerging. You can see for the first time in several years, rather than being flat or declining during the course of the year, the top box on the left summarizes U.S. exposure and performance of public equities. So we have about $8.7 billion invested in development. 24% across top debt and ICF. You can see our return for the 12 months end of June is about 23% for developed markets and 21 to 26% for emerging markets. As Britt mentioned, on an absolute return basis, in developed countries, our non-U.S. exposure was very helpful. Japan and Europe markets appreciated 20+% versus the U.S. market, which returned 17%. In emerging markets, our exposure to China and Asia. Relative return basis, in developed countries, we had strong stock selection by several managers, pretty broad-based across various regions. And then in emerging markets, we were hurt by an overweight to Brazil, small caps, and in Jeff and ITF, this was offset by strong stock selection. And the difference in PUF returns and Jeff and ITF returns in emerging markets was due to
so the, one of the things about this advance is, you know, you go through the obviously the drawdown, and you go through the recovery, which is basically just getting back to the previous peak, and almost all that will turn out to be PE multiple expansion rather than actual earnings growth. And so for the first, you know, 7 or so years of this advance in U.S. equity markets at the bottom line level, not each individual sector, but aggregated at the bottom line, it was almost all PE multiple expansion, going from 11 times to, you know, 18 to 20 times, depending on how you want to measure it. So just to make that clear, if you had a company that had $10 in earnings and the multiple is 10, it's over 100. If it had still had $10 in earnings 10 years later and sold for a multiple of 20, it sold for 200. So you got a 100% increase just because of the stabilization of the backdrop of the American economy. And now we're getting into the earnings growth phase, which is the final, you know, the final page phase in the expansion. And we're seeing for the first time in our country in a while, we're actually having earnings growth, and then they're actually having earnings growth that's stronger outside of the country. And China, surprisingly, has had the most positive surprising earnings growth of any market in the country that I'm aware of, you know, so far this year. So 8 years into the expansion, equity markets going up 20%. This is not something you read about in your textbooks. Our guys did very well in developed markets, and in most places also did very well in emerging markets. The best performing asset class, though, surprisingly, you know, this is a little bit counterintuitive, was our natural resources portfolio that Mark oversees. So Mark, could you explain this to us?
Sure. A little bit simpler than Susan's four quadrant. But basically, most of the returns and resources at this point are in our private natural resources portfolio. We've liquidated most of our public equities because we had built up our exposure on our private side. And over a longer term basis, they earn a significant spread over what we've been earning in the public equity. So this is all private equity. So you can see the markups for the year were $630 million, which is the column on the far right. And then the columns on the left are the decomposition of that. So our energy upstream portfolio, which is roughly half of our exposure, had the biggest write-ups, $426 million. Of that, there were three companies that drove most of that. Two of them were sold. So those are actual returns, not just marks. We had a company that was sold 4.2 times our initial investment. or $162 million. Importantly, that company prior to its exit was marked at 2.4. So it was held in the books at 2.4 times. It sold at 4.2 times. Second company was sold for 2.3 times, or $92 million. Its prior mark, prior to the exit, was 1.5. And I just use that to illustrate, as I've shown the board before, that we tend to, over time, experience better exits than where our marks are by our partners. That was the case in both of these exits. They were both domestic upstream companies. So the average multiple was 3.4x net to us. We invested $74 million and made $254. The other is a midstream asset that was actually a spin-out of one of those upstream oil and gas companies. We took their midstream infrastructure assets, capitalized them separately. That company was marked up from a 1.9x to a 5.2x, principally because its assets were in service and started generating significant cash flow. It's a Permian-based oil pipeline system right in the heart of where some of the best production in the country is. So combined, those were most of the $426 million. You can see the other areas had lower impacts on NAV, but great returns. So the energy midstream, metals and mining, and energy upstream areas all increased by 30% during the year. So 30% rate of return in 1 year on those NAVs. And so combined, we grew the NAV of the resources book from $2.3 billion up to $3.5 billion, and half of that was in calls and half of that was in these write-ups.
Thank you, Mark. And so those of you who follow the public markets, you know, if you look at the public market returns in energy, they've been very weak, and yet our private market returns have been very strong. Maybe you say a little bit about without being too specific, about what you have in the pipeline.
In terms of new investments or what our partners are doing?
In terms of expectations for realizations.
Well, so we've got, so as I said, about half the natural resources portfolio is energy. The other half is infrastructure, mining, and agriculture. In particular, we have a very large investment in emerging infrastructure in some of the growing economies, and we have one partner who's selling their entire two portfolios of their first two funds as one big sale. They've got indicative bids this month. That's a $4 to $5 billion exit, of which our proportion will be hundreds of millions of dollars. So if that one gets liquidated, a big part of our infrastructure book will come back to us in the form of pretty attractive returns this year. As well, about half of our energy portfolio is outside the U.S., and we're starting to get really interesting indications from global players on some of our non-North America energy assets as well. So we think there could be some more decent-sized realizations this year in that portfolio.
Rick, could I ask a couple of questions?
Yes, sir.
When we look at the amazing outperformance over the benchmark, or maybe this is for Mark. Mark, how do you think about the benchmark in relation to our portfolio? How is it constructed, or how is it similar? How is it different to our book? Because 1,000 basis points is awesome.
Unusual, yeah.
So in that particular slide that Britt showed you, that's all of our natural resources combined and all their benchmarks combined. So if you disaggregate them, I think primarily what you're probably asking is about our private book, because that's by far the biggest NAV at this point. You know, we construct you a benchmark that's as similar to what we do as we possibly can. So it's 80% the Cambridge energy benchmark and 20% their infrastructure benchmarks added together. That's what we comp ourselves against. I can just tell you that it's composed of mostly domestic. You know, it's just invested differently than what we've actually done in our portfolio. So it's mostly domestic upstream private equity players, and we're a bit more diversified than that. So. Yeah, but we've constructed a benchmark that we measure ourselves against that's as close to our actual implementation as we've been able to do.
Yeah, so for all the new board members, so Cambridge is really the source for almost all the private equity benchmarks, and they slice and dice them every way you possibly can. Benchmarking in private, as everybody knows, particularly on a short-term basis, is the most difficult thing to do. But while most people's, one of the things that I didn't mention in an earlier slide, that the returns for private equity have come way down. Now, our returns are still reasonably high, but the returns for private equity in general have come down to sort of 6 to 8% type numbers, but our guys have still been putting up 15 to 20% numbers. And they've sworn to me that they'll do that for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Forever and ever.
And if you could also,
the last two slides that have been shown aren't in the board book or the electronic version. If you could make sure we get those, that would be great.
Absolutely. We'll do. All right. So that's all the returns. Now let's just kind of look at how it affects, you know, the universities and all of our other clients. I had this slide made, and you know, now it's made, I should have probably done it in a slightly different order. But what I'm really trying to do here is just show you how much money is coming into the funds that's not from investment proceeds, and how much is being paid out. So if you look at the bottom, you see the contributions from Elanco and from other sources. And so over the course of the last 12 months, you know, we got in $937 million from various sources, primarily from Elanco. Now, this is, as you think about other endowments around the country, this is a very unusual, just to state the obvious, you know, a very unusual mix. You know, for us to have the benefit of a Elanco, which is throwing off $600 million to $1.2 billion per year, rather than having to rely exclusively on, you know, the generosity of alumni, is quite a unique circumstance for endowments. So we got a $937 million from sources, and we paid out $1.2 billion. And you can see how these payouts worked out, the different institutions. The important thing for our side is that means the net outflow from the funds, from the endowment, is only $300 million per year. So the endowment payout on a net basis, principally because of Elanco, is extremely low. I'm used to payouts that are 5%, you know, much bigger numbers than this. If you look at the chart on the bottom right, you basically see the net payouts, and it's difficult to see in that line up there, but, you know, up until, you know, the late 2000 period, there were actually positive net contributions to the funds, not payouts at all. You know, since that time, it's dropped down to about 2 or 3% negative, but that is a very small number in terms of payouts. All right. Now just kind of going into markets in general. So here's kind of where we are on a very big picture basis, and I'll dive in, and Greg's going to get even more granular. But we're in a circumstance right now where there really almost every market in the world is fully valued. And this is not something that's normally you can find one market or two markets in the world of some substance that, you know, is not, you know, not clearly fully valued. So stock markets are above their median in terms of their valuations. Private equity multiples are at or near all-time highs. Real estate cap rates, this is on commercial real estate, are close to all-time lows. And the one thing that's the one market that's uncertain is the energy market, which has already had, as everybody in this room knows, you know, a major collapse. And in my mind, you know, we're still trying to determine what the future holds. Normally, the future will leave, because it's a supply-driven problem. You get into a trading range. You know, that's what happened last time. We had a supply-driven problem. So if that's the circumstance now, the trading range could be something like 25 to 50. If, in fact, we establish a new norm with OPEC centering around $60, the other could be 40 to 70. Many of you around this table know a lot more about the energy markets than I do. The prices have been averaging, you know, been bouncing around between the low 40s and low 50s for a while, and so I don't think it's very clear which direction it's going to go. Here's the concern, and the top chart is the concern. I'm still on the energy cycle. The top chart is the concern. The bottom chart is the hope. We had a tech and telecom bubble, then we had a financial bubble, primarily in debt. And then we had a bubble in energy. So what you saw in both of the previous two bubbles is pretty similar declines, then a pretty good rally in the short run, and then it was dead money for, you know, 8 or 10 years. And that's kind of how we're tracking right now. On the other hand, the relative strength of energy versus the rest of the markets is, you know, close to an all-time low. So, you know, this is an area that's very important to this fund because of our source of funding and because of our natural resources exposure, even though our guys have been able to overcome some of these trends And so this is something we're going to have to watch very closely. Now, turning to, you know, we're 8.5 years out into an economic cycle. And what is important to realize, what ends economic cycles? And the answer is recession, commodity spike, some either mistake by the Fed or the Fed intentionally ending the party, an event, and then when one of those four things happens, then you get, it's kind of like, are we overvalued? And then you get the correction. So I'll talk about recession in just a second. On this, when I talk about the panic attacks here on the right-hand side, there have been many false alarms along the way. This is one of the reasons you just have to have a steady hand in terms of how you're, you know, running the portfolio. Because they say greed is cumulative, fear is instantaneous. Greed is cumulative, fear is instantaneous. And so 59 times during this period of time, there was a small correction. And if you bid on just 10% of those, which I think a lot of people did, it turned out that every single time you did it, it was wrong. It could be, at some point it'll be right. But so far it's 59-0. Commodity spikes, we've already had the commodity spike down. We talked about that a little bit. In terms of speculative valuation, we're at higher than normal valuations, but we're not at speculative levels with regard to valuation, particularly if interest rates stay close to where they are, and we do continue to get some earnings growth. So eventually this thing will turn around. This is, as far as I know, night always follows day, and up markets are always followed by down markets, and so it's important to have some history in terms of how this works. So on the left-hand side, you see all the bull markets we've had since 1926. And, the average change in a bull market is 156% increase. This time we're at close to 300% increase. Of course, we're coming off a particularly significant downturn. And not only that, they only last, for 4.5 years, and now we're at 8.5 years. So things do not die of old age. They die of one of these things I talked about, occurring, recessions, commodity spikes, Fed policy, or some major event. Whenever this thing does turn around, and there are 7 billion people on the planet, and so there will be 5, who will somehow get this right when that occurs, and the rest of us will have to, just be prepared and respond to it and make sure that we're strong hands when it actually happens. But when that does happen, the markets typically move down in the sort of 45% area. So in terms of a risk overview, this is going back for this full expansion. So I'm going to go down the left-hand side first. UTEMCO is up 127% from the market low, with the policy up 101%. When you look at the S&P, the S&P is up 294%. Emerging markets are up 147%. Resources are only up 26%. That's one of the things that Mark mentioned. Looking at the metrics below, at the bottom of the cycle, the stock, this is on a trailing basis, the PE was 11 times. And again, on a trailing basis today, it's 20 times. So just, even if you didn't have any earnings growth at all, the multiple has caused a doubling of the price of your security. The implied volatility at the peak, when we were filled with fear, was 49% of the VIX. Today it's down at it's even lower than this now at 11. I want you to point out the balance sheet. So how did this lift occur? And you could name a few things, but the most significant thing is central banks. So if you look here at the beginning, the balance sheet of the central banks between the U.S. and the ECB, and then if you added the BOJ, it'd be even different, bigger, with $4.5 trillion. Now those two banks are up to almost $8 trillion. If you add in the BOJ, it's getting close to $13 trillion. So there's been a massive amount of monetary stimulation that's been put into this economy to lift. If you go all the way back to that global equity range, the whole point is to lift the economy up into that global equity range so people will feel comfortable or feel forced to you know, reallocate their assets towards what, you know, sort of more productive things. Across the top are some bear market indicators that we follow. It's way too small to read here, but there are 24 of them. And unless 50% of those bear market indicators are going off, then our belief is, you know, that a bear market is not imminent. Now, of course, every time you say that, that by itself makes it imminent. But, and then on the one on the side is what we call a bubble monitor indicator. So we monitor for bubbles all over the world in over 100 markets. And this is a very simple indicator. It really just has to do with the strength of the returns over the last short period of time relative to history. And that red line is where the bubbles are. And so nothing is in bubble territory at the moment, but the things that are highest up are the U.S. stock markets. In terms of whenever this thing does turn around, what we've done here is show you three different results. You know, one is a light drawdown, meaning just have a very, you know, you do have a correction, but it's on the minor side. The fund would probably go down 16%. If we have a normal correction, it goes down 23%. And if we have a severe correction, it goes down 36%. If you say, well, that could never happen, please look at the previous numbers, 34% and 27%. So this is not something that when it occurs will be enjoyable. But the main thing is that we have to be strong hands when it happens. We'll do what we can to avoid as much as we can, but we're not going to be able to avoid all of it or even probably most of it. The main thing is you have to be ready to do something significant afterwards when everybody else is out of the market. Risk dashboard, you've seen this as a slightly modified from what Uzi's shown you, but relatively similar. Just want to concentrate mostly on the ones that are on the right-hand side. There are three bullets to the brain in terms of risks: excessive concentration, excessive illiquidity, and excessive leverage. And so there in the concentration, you see with the top 20%, our top 20 managers have 40% of our assets. But on a risk-adjusted basis, that's 23% of the risk. A lot of those are bond managers and so on. So it's not as extreme as it seems. On the illiquidity side, that 19.5% unfunded commitments is about $5 billion of unfunded commitments. The about $2.7 billion of that is scheduled to be committed over the next 14 to 18 months. Now, remember, that's the commitments. What's not shown up here are the distributions. So in the past year, that amount of commitments is, we're going to take a look at it, but it's relatively high, but it's not excessively higher than what we've had in the past. The difference between our commitments and our distributions has been about $600 million. So if it comes in at $600 million again, it's not a significant problem. So that's on those sides down there.
Fred, let me ask you, there was, I think, one or two cycles ago, we were concerned that the distributions out of the private equity portfolio was at a historical low relative to our amount of investment. Are we seeing any improvement? And there was a whole list of reasons given why this was possibly the case.
Yeah. So, Mark may want to elaborate on this more. The distributions a year ago actually came in pretty high. And now they've dropped down again, but not to any kind of long-term low. So distributions rose, now they've dropped, and Uzi is looking at what we expect the distributions to be in the next 18 months.
Is that across all categories? Like, I'm thinking about M&A, it's sort of down right now.
Yeah. Credit distributions have risen.
And, lastly, I think this is an interesting dashboard, but maybe it needs a little clarity. I don't know. Maybe the other board members find it very enlightening, but we've always wanted a snapshot of risk. And do the people here around the table think that this gives them an adequate feel for the risk, or would we like, and we don't have to decide this today, but more clarity around illiquidity, concentration, markets.
It'd be good to know if it's gotten better or gotten worse. So what was
some trend analysis, yeah. Versus the snapshot. Yes, yes. Good point. Yeah, how over time, how are we doing?
Yeah, got it. That's another thing would be, with some of these, do we have specific policies that we're supposed to stay inside of? So say with illiquidity. Like, do we have a metric that we're supposed to stay inside of, and how close are we to that?
And we do have metrics, and so Jen, so they're, right now they're here on this page: 90-day liquidity, 1-year liquidity. We've just expanded it through the policy. So, but I probably will propose a different liquidity metric between now and next year in terms of multiple of distributions.
Just for a historical perspective, it might be interesting to see how we were positioned before these two drawdowns on the previous chart.
And then also, Brett, with I think it's about 55% is public, 45 private. Yeah. If you get into one of these larger drawdowns where your public book is.
And what it could go to.
And are the allocation bands flexible and sufficient enough to weather that? Are you going to be chasing your tail a little bit?
So you want to stay away from being forced to do anything.
Yeah.
And that's
exactly.
That's the main thing. We have to be in a situation where we know we're going to be strong hands, after a decline. It's a little bit of a fool's errand to think you're going to predict a decline, and we'll just do what we can. But the most important thing is you have to be prepared when the valuations are good and when everybody else is afraid and when blood is running in the street and all the levered players are unable to act, and all those kind of things. And so that's what I really want to concentrate on. I'd be remiss not to leave this page without, so they're all the risks. This is the bottom left, you see the results of active management. So over the course of the last year, the investment team here produced $1.165 billion of value added above the benchmark. So congratulations to them for that.
Real value.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Real money.
Real money.
So here's just kind of bringing this in for a landing. This is the volatility of the fund on different time horizons. And all the academics focus on 1 year. What is your 1 year standard deviation? And, this is not a 1 year plan. This is a long-term plan. And so, the blue line is the 1 year, and you see how it goes all over the place. Gold line or yellow line is our 10-year annualized standard deviation, which is almost a straight line, at about 9%. And that's what we need to stay focused on. This is a little bit leading into Greg, because Greg and Bridgewater love to use these cone charts. So basically this is saying, going back to 1996 when the fund was formed, what would have been the expected outcomes over a long period of time, and are you above or below what you would have expected? And so, what you see here is through about 2007, until that that correction occurred, the fund was operating really above expectations. The red line is the policy, the green line is the actual performance. Ever since the correction occurred, the policy of the portfolio, the red line, has operated about a third of a standard deviation below, expectations for the reasons that I cited and Mark cited a minute ago. But the active management of the fund has made up the difference between the two. Now, if you believe in regression to the mean, which I think most of us do over a period of time, even the policy part should correct. All right. Two more slides and then I'm done. Here's an interesting, going into Landco. So we talked about the fact that, we have this very unique sourcing of our portfolio, and it's this 2 million acres of West Texas land and all of the proceeds that flow off of that land, the lowest being, the high $500 million area, the high being $1.2 billion. We just put a value on here, which most people consider to be very conservative. And, you know, what this is showing here, if you look at the two boxes, is it's really trying to show what kind of diversification you have in various economic environments. Going back to that first page that I showed you before, recessions, you know, equity environment, recessions, equity environments, and real return. And so on the left-hand side, you see the sensitivities of the fund without Ulanco, at which point we have very little sensitivity to rising inflation. And then when you throw Ulanco in, it changes the entire outlook. And so we're going to have to spend some time over the course of the next year or so working with Mark Hauser and people like that and Mark Warner in trying to determine, you know, how to account for this, because it's a really unusual circumstance for our fund.
And you're valuing West Texas Lands at $10
billion? That's it. Yep. And that's just an arbitrary, you know, relatively arbitrary number. I've been told by higher sources that it's low. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'd rather not say what number they said.
Drive your yields down. Yeah. So this is Puff and Ulanco, just the Puff,
yes.
Right, not the total 40 plus the...
Right, this
yeah.
All right, so here's the summary. You know, we could have these kinds of years every year. You know, this would be a very happy time. And so one of the things, that when you're in the investment business for a long time, you should enjoy the ups. You know, you should enjoy them because, you know, that's not always going to be the case. So try to enjoy them as much as you can. This is an up period. So, you know, total assets have grown to over $40 billion. We've made, you know, $4.9 billion recently. The returns are 13% plus. The alpha is very, very strong, first quartile. We have to understand that, you know, we're in an extended cycle. The valuations are stretched. The risk premiums are low. Greg will get into that in a minute. But economic conditions, as Susan pointed out, are very favorable, you know, right now. One of the things on the risk chart that I forgot to mention is, you know, all the Federal Reserves, you know, put out their estimates of what the likelihood of recession is. And so the likelihood of recession for the U.S. over the next 12 months or so is 20%. Believe it or not, the likelihood for recession, according to the Europeans, over the next 12 months is 10%. Now, you know, these are all extremely educated, scientific, wild guesses. But, you know, that is what it is right now. The commodity spike seems unlikely. The central banks are clearly in play. You know, if we have a circumstance right now, it seems like it's going to be triggered by an event, you know, rather than, you know, one of these other factors. And we could sit here and name 50 events, you know, that without any trouble. But so far, you know, none of those events have come out. At the end of the day, the bottom line is, you know, we have to be a top-tier fund. We have to have maximum exercise of our advantages, which we are large. It's an advantage, not a disadvantage. Net, not in every way, but net, it's an advantage. You know, we have adequate liquidity to survive, you know, some of these knockdowns. Last time this happened, I actually showed a film of a fighter who, in the first round, got knocked completely out of the ring. You know, took a punch, got knocked completely out of the ring, but then climbed back into the ring and three rounds later, you know, won the fight. You know, we have to be that kind of person, that kind of enterprise that can sustain sort of whatever happens in the defense of it. So strong hands is the mantra, and that is the goal, and that is what we'll have. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my report.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's see.
Rick, can I ask you one
question? Yeah, any questions?
So when I think about risk, I kind of think about it as three separate risks. One is the risk that we discussed, kind of absolute risk as it relates to liquidity, leverage, and concentration. We kind of have another risk, which is the risk of our portfolio versus the policy portfolio, whether we're underweighted, overweighted. And then the third risk is kind of our relative risk as far as performance is concerned to our peers. Right? And as you were coming in, the staff had done a comprehensive review of asset allocation, policy portfolio, and the direction of that policy portfolio prior to your arrival was more towards the mean of our peer group. And I'm curious to know how you're thinking about asset allocation as it relates to the to our peer group? And are you moving, going to be moving towards that mean, or working towards that mean, or are you going to take a new approach? I'm curious to think about that third risk as it relates to us versus our peers.
So, you know, over a 10-year period, you know, that gap between UTEMCO and the median of the peers that we talked about that was, you know, has been eliminated. So, so at this point, when you look at the top line level, the asset allocation of our fund and the asset allocation of the typical top, you know, 20 peer fund are pretty similar. So, you know, I'm pretty comfortable right there for right now. Underneath the hood, you know, we have, and it's paid off for us over the course of the last year, you know, a significantly different allocation in our private equity portfolio versus other people's private equity portfolio, particularly the one that Mark referred to. You know, we have, first of all, we have more natural resources, and then even within the natural resources, we you know, have a very different implementation of how it all works. So, you know, this will give us a chance to, but the liquidity premium, you know, so if you're looking for liquidity premium in a down in private equity, that has definitely shrunk. The actual return for developed equity private markets probably through September is going to be more like 6%, you know, rather than the, you know, 9 to 15% number that it actually has been. And there's a tremendous amount of dry powder, over $1 trillion of dry powder in the private markets, which needs to be sopped up. So they're paying very high prices. They're actually paying prices that are above strategic, you know, right now in some principal things. So we're going to have to be very targeted, you know, in the way we implement our private market portfolio. But, you know, all the risk premiums are still there, you know, but they're just a lot smaller, you know, than they were before. So when you're just talking about, you know, the allocation of the fund, the risk premium setup is not really changed the way you would set up a fund. It just means that, you know, all the returns have been shifted down, and the risk premiums that you're getting from a liquid market, instead of being 400 or 500 basis points, looks like it's going to be maybe 300 basis points.
Okay. Thanks. Well, I'd love to ask you if one of the most helpful pieces of work that I've seen from the board's perspective is risk relative to, you know, performance quartiles of our peers. Yes. Mm-hmm. And the staff had put together an asset allocation mean for the peers called mean and median. Yes. And shows us how we relate to the peers. I'd love to keep adding that to the board.
Okay.
Book.
Okay.
From our perspective. We're really,
yeah,
really helpful.
Yeah, that's easy to do.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I just had one. Are you,
Robert,
coming in and getting a fresh look at the portfolio and the allocation, and there has been a rush to the illiquid side of the institutional world trying to capture alpha? And are you comfortable today with where we are, or do you feel like there's some tactical, kind of big tactical shifts you need to make? And you threw the Ulanco allocation in with the overall.
Yeah.
So
at my after 5 weeks.
Yeah. Is that too much? I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's, you know, I'm comfortable enough to, you know, so, you know, we went through the policy committee and we basically said, look, you know, rather than continue to expand this number to a much higher number in the short run, we're going to just stop here. Sort of, you know, while return expectations are low and private equity markets are low, and we're going to need liquidity, you know, at a time, you know, whenever the this correction does come, that, you know, we would stop here at this particular point and assess over the course of the next year where we actually need to be.
Gotcha.
Some funds have used secondary markets to sell off, you know, excessive percentages to the in the private market portfolio. I asked Mark about it, and certainly something that we've looked at, but not something that we feel, you know, really compelled to do right now.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, I think with that, Britt, would you like to introduce our guest?
I certainly would. So, you know, we have Greg Jensen here and his colleague Alan Bowser. I know where Alan is, so right back here. Greg is the co-CIO of Bridgewater Associates. Bridgewater is, depending on the day, the world's largest hedge fund. It's also renowned as, you know, there, believe it or not, you know, I guess in every industry there are surveys with regard to who's most respected, and Bridgewater is always either the most respected or one of the most respected investment organizations in the world. It is completely independent. It's, I was telling some of you this morning, you know, it started in the garage, in the apartment of Ray Dalio, and struggled mightily until Greg Jensen showed up. And, you know, after Greg showed up, seems to have soared. So I just asked Greg if he would just kind of come in and give his assessment of the environment going forward.
Great.
And he's the co-CIO at Bridgewater.
So, first off, thank you. This is really part of our mission at Bridgewater is to have great conversations with important decision makers on how to save, how to invest. Bridgewater, over those 40 years, has really just focused on two questions. One is, how does the global financial system work? And the second is, how do you invest? So when Britt refers to us as the largest hedge fund in the world or whatever, that's sort of accidental. We never set out or even knew what a hedge fund was when Bridgewater was started. The focus is on those two questions and the implementation of really understanding how the global financial system works and the best ways to invest happens to be a hedge fund's a good way to utilize alpha and to have conversations like this. And we have our all-weather product, but to have conversations like this on the best ways to invest, for which what you're speaking to as your policy portfolio would be one thing, and alpha, like you might do in a hedge fund or in other sources, would be a different thing. So we've spent 40 years thinking about those two questions, compounding our understanding. So what Bridgewater actually does and has done for 40 years and really has the most important thing that has separated us, in our view, from our peers in the investment world is that everything that we've ever learned over 40 years, which has been a lot because we've made so many mistakes, that we've written down those learnings over the years, that's been transitioned into algorithms that reflect everything that we learn. And all we're focused on, because we've written down the rules for everything that we've come to understand about how to trade markets, how to build portfolios, we can focus all of our energy on what we're wrong about. So I brought with me as an example, every week we have this packet, our What's Going On in the World packet, that we do our Monday morning meetings, like you guys are doing today, but we do this with this many pages brought to us by our researchers on all the things they think we might be wrong about that we haven't built into our process. So that we go through this, and from this book of things, call our radar, all the blips that are happening in the world that we need to be aware of, we translate that into research projects, and we continue to improve our process by researching the biggest areas that we might be missing, adding them in to our built-up algorithms, and continuing on in that process. So everything that I'm going to talk about what we're seeing in the world is a function of this process that's been built for 40 years, that's been stress-tested across history, across time, across countries, and then very much so in real time. That's what will be sort of behind the remarks that I'm making. So, and it's really this. We've had a great relationship with UTIMCO for a long time, but largely it's been of the nature of thinking about Bridgewater as a hedge fund, and much less so than some of your peers anyway, on these strategic questions of how to invest, given the world that we all face and the difficulties of that world. And so so we hope you guys will take advantage of that at this level as well, and have started to, and certainly our long relationship with Britt may help that as well. So that's where I'll start. So Britt put together four questions for me, which we then organized my comments around. Let's see if I can. Britt was able to work this, so let's see if I can. All right. So the four questions were, where are we in the current cycles, and how has that impacted markets? Second question was, what are market pricing now? What are your long-term expectations for asset performance, and how would you approach investing in the current environment? So we'll just organize the comments around those four questions. I'll start here on page four. The first thing I would note, having studied economies, all major economies across hundreds of years of history, we think, and then systemizing all those learnings, that you can boil down
the major things in an economy in a fairly simple way to get a reliable understanding of what drives economics and then markets. The first thing is, in terms of economy, there's really three major forces you have to be aware of. One is productivity. What's the underlying growth? This is the long-term source of returns in the equity market, earnings growth. So understanding the long-term developments in productivity are clearly really important, although in the short term, they hardly matter at all because the other cycles create more volatility in the short term, even though productivity will determine the outcomes in the long term. The short-term debt cycle, which is the thing we're most sort of all experienced with because it happens many times in our lifetimes, there's the ups and downs in the wiggles of the economy, largely driven by central banks easing and tightening monetary policy as a function of inflation, but they'd be driven for other reasons if that wasn't the mechanism. And then the third is the long-term debt cycle, which is probably the least understood and generally, much like productivity, is ignored until you hit major turning points. So the long-term debt cycle is a reinforcing process that when things go well, the people that levered more tend to do the best. They get, therefore, more money is attracted into more leverage to that growth. That cycle tends to build up for many, many decades and then tends to turn down for many, many decades. So these can be, you know, 50, 75-year cycles that are then affecting the business cycle, but it's much harder to notice because there are fewer turning points. But if you go through the history of financial markets, these cycles are as apparent as the business cycles and really critical, particularly because we're living through a major turning point in the long-term debt cycle. And then if you're understanding markets, there's really three major equilibriums that at least we think we utilize to make money in markets, that essentially three things eventually will come in line. The first is that debt growth has to be in line with income over long enough time periods. So you can't extend anything that's an extrapolation of a debt growth that's faster than income growth is a dangerous thing. The second is that economic capacity utilization will eventually be used or destroyed. So you can't have underutilized resources for too long a period of time. And the third is that the projected returns of assets above the projected returns of risk of less risk assets should be aligned with their risk. To the extent there's a disequilibrium because too much money flows into one asset or another relative to its risk, eventually with time, those things will converge. And then on the right side, there's basically two levers that policymakers have to affect those equilibriums, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, but two major levers. One is monetary policy, and the second is fiscal policy. And so when you're thinking about the world today, of course, it's the ability and ease with which those levers can be pulled that affect the control that policymakers have on creating outcomes in the real economy. Today, we're, of course, at a point where monetary policy, particularly the ability to ease monetary policy, is limited by the nature of the tools that they have. That creates one type of issue that when you go into the next, as Britt said, eventually there will be a turndown. When you go into that turndown, knowing that the tools are limited to offset that is a very important thing to be considering how to deal with. And secondly, on fiscal policy, of course, one of the issues with fiscal policy as a lever is the needed coordination, and through at least much of the developed world, the coordination needed to utilize fiscal policy in any intelligent way is modest, to say the least. So that means that the levers that generally available to policymakers are probably more limited than at most times through history. So in our study of markets, understanding those forces, those equilibriums, and those levers, that's kind of the simplified version to understand almost everything that we've learned. So now applying those to today's conditions and understanding today's conditions, why the world is in such a good spot cyclically, despite being in a very difficult spot secularly, is important because the business cycle interacts with the long-term debt cycle. So today, we have a very good world in the sense that a very good world from just a pure economic cycle because you can have a lot of growth without hardly any inflation. And the reason you can is that there's major secular deflationary forces working in the backdrop. Globalization, technology, and the high debt levels, and demographics to a certain extent, are together creating a massive
secular deflationary wave that's allowing a short-term cyclical massive liquidity push to play out without creating the normal reaction, which would be an inflationary reaction. And so those things are working out right now, and they're creating the cyclical and secular conditions are at odds, which is creating what we would describe as sort of this false calm in the world, because you have two massive pressures, a massive cyclical upswing from one of the most significant creation of money in the history of the world, offset by a secular deflationary phase, creating a very calm, offsetting and creating a very calm circumstance. But those two pressures are so strong that eventually one of them, that balance not working out, and one of those pressures exceeding the other, creating a significant turning point, is important to be monitoring. So we've got that the cyclical conditions of high liquidity, a rebounding growth, probably accommodation from central banks, and then the secular problems that we face, which we'll get into more, is the very low return on assets. So Britt mentioned this to some degree, although there's aspects that I would say a little bit differently, that markets are pricing in returns on assets that physically are going to be much lower than the history. The odds that the next 30 years of UTIMCO's policy portfolio making returns anything like the last 30 years are extremely low, just mathematically, because you start with a risk-free rate that's essentially close to zero. You add in the risks that you're taking, and the benefits of taking those risks are actually probably a little bit smaller than they have been in history. That adds up that you actually should expect in the next decade the policy portfolio to do about half as well or a little less than that than it has done in the last 30 years. And that's a really important thing to start planning for, and that's true across everybody. So first off, good time to hire Britt. It's a very hard job, so you guys will be able to put a lot of pressure on him. But but this problem of the math of asset pricing, what does it mean to have yields where they are? What does that mean for the aggregate of these portfolios and the long-term growth rates is creating what we call the big squeeze, which is that there are so many entities in the developed world that have wealth that are planning to use that wealth to pay for promises that have made. And given where bond yields are and equity prices are, those promises are unachievable. So one way or the other, the promises are going to have to be changed to achieve them. In some way, somebody's either going to have to pay more taxes or receive less benefits to achieve that, because the wealth cannot create the income necessary to achieve all the promises. That by itself is a secular, essentially deflationary pressure that's going on. And as a result of that, and we think you're seeing this as a result of those secular pressures, the technology, the deflationary pressures, and the fact that they don't hit every individual equally, is part of creating the underlying conditions that create massive polarity. We use the 1930s as, we think, somewhat representative in terms of a mix of technological and secular changes that created underneath it, and debt problems globally, that created underneath it a set of winners and losers that created massive polarity in the outcomes and in the feeling about those outcomes. So while there'll be ebbs and flows in populist pressures in the developed world, the bigger cycle is clear, that winners and losers are happening at a very rapid rate and changing those things, which is creating a set of pressures, which will be, in the end, very important to the global financial landscape and how the rules are applied. So if you go down to page 6, these charts are showing what's happening with global liquidity. And I just want to really point to this one here on the bottom left. There's never been, this is the amount of cash in the world. There's 110% of GDP, of global GDP, in cash today. There's never been anything like that. That's the massive production of liquidity. The Fed created liquidity. This is the creation of liquidity by the Fed. This blue line here, as the Fed came off and ended quantitative easing in 2015, Japan and Europe offset that end of quantitative easing. That's what's shown in the red line. And as a result, global cash balances are massive. And if you include in top of just cash, the amount of assets held with yields less than 1%, that's another 55% of GDP. So there's 165% of GDP, way more than any point in history, in cash and cash-like assets. So what that's done, that liquidity creation, has moved out the risk curve, driven all asset prices up. It's also when we're talking about why all the dips have been bought, well, there's so much liquidity that every time there's a dip, somebody sees it as an opportunity to come in. There's so much cash that each one of those dips are bought as a result of that cash. And that improvement in the liquidity condition, as was talked about before, has flowed through to the economy such that the global economy is now growing at about 4.25%, which is reasonably well above potential growth rates and a reasonably positive development. And that if you took, that's pretty well spread across countries. You got about 85% of the countries growing faster than their potential growth rates today. And that's, based on our estimates, actually likely to go to about 95% over the next year. So most countries are growing well. That growth is coordinated. We think it's a function of the liquidity that's been produced, finding different homes across the world. Every pocket of the global economy, for the most part, is seeing the benefit of that tremendous liquidity that has been created. And central banks have been purposely, historically, extremely accommodative in letting that happen. So if you take, typically it would be normal, when we get into this, that interest rates would be close to nominal growth rates. And yet you've had the rebound, if you take the U.S., the rebound in nominal growth rates that are well above interest rates. The red line there is the interest rate, the blue is nominal growth rates. And the Fed has been very slow, in part due to the recognition of the secular conditions, very slow in bringing interest rates back in line with nominal growth rates. We think that in a period of deleveraging, that is wise. Having growth rates higher than interest rates is allowing the economy to be okay and debts relative to incomes in the private sector to start to decline. You're seeing that all across the developed world, as shown there. And by and large, the markets are expecting, this is showing the discounted forward real yield of cash, about zero. The markets are by and large pricing in only very modest central bank tightening. So that takes us to the next page here, 9, which shows what's priced in. So the markets are pricing in. The Fed brought interest rates to zero. The quantitative easing, as we translate that into interest rate changes, sort of brought interest rates down to something like -3% as they removed that interest rates to zero. And now the markets are pricing in something like a very gradual tightening to 1.5% or something like that over the next few years. The ECB is now starting to be priced to begin tapering the quantity of their flows, not raising interest rates, but begin tapering the quantity of liquidity production. And similarly, the BOJ is very gradually beginning to slow down their quantity of quantitative easing as well. Finally, probably the country that's furthest along in tightening is China, has tightened more significantly than the rest of the major central banks, and that's something of a little bit bigger concern, which we'll talk about in a second, but China has started to tighten modestly and has succeeded in bringing down financial institution to financial institution leverage a tremendous amount over the last 9 months, which was really the target of that tightening. So if we then say, okay, well, one of the major turning points, the most common turning point in cycles is central bank tightening. And now all the central banks are moving, albeit very gradually, towards tightening. And this is a dashboard that we use to say, are there indications that the central banks are tightening too much? Which we would take these 5 ideas as sort of the types of ideas we would systemize in our process and say, okay, well, interest rates, is the interest rate led by long-term rates? So it's the Fed's tightening too slowly if the long rate is rising faster than the short rate. You take in the U.S. and China's case, actually the short rate is rising faster than the long rate, which would be indicative of the central banks starting to tighten faster. But in Europe, Japan, and the U.K., that's not the case. So then are the
interest rates rising slower than or faster than what's priced in would be another condition. Again, across most of the world, that's been yes. In the U.S. and China, it's a little bit different. And so when we look through this grid, by and large globally, with some concerns in China at the rate of the tightening, that by and large globally, the central banks are still acting very accommodatively and very cautiously, which leaves room for the current business cycle to continue to move forward. Before I get too far ahead, I just wanted to quickly make a point about commodities. It's obviously very important here that we believe we are now past the bottom in the investment cycle in commodities, that you had a huge global commodity boom in commodity capex, a massive cut in commodity investment as prices collapsed. That quantity of investment, when we model out what that translates into supply, you're getting close across most commodities where there is a shortage of supply relative to the needs, considering where the global economy is in its growth cycle, that this decline in capex is too little. I mean, the amount of quantity of capex is too little to create the aggregate supply of commodities. That's shown up in almost every commodity except for oil. You've already seen a significant price increase and a shortage in most commodity markets over the last year. And oil obviously has a few things going on that complicates the overall supply-demand because there's been such a massive productivity increase. And so even with fewer dollars of capex, the quantity of oil increase has been faster than the decline in capex would have made you think. But we are crisscrossing. It's just really important to realize that if you take the world oil supply, that's in blue here, and the world oil demand. So we've been through 4 years of a massive excess of supply relative to demand. That has just closed. 2017 will mark the first year in the last five where oil demand will almost certainly outpace oil supply growth. And so we're setting up a circumstance, and while it's obviously very different here in that there's lots of opportunity and lots of oil, globally, this decline in capex is just starting to flow through to some of the more expensive places where oil was being produced and where the lags are much longer than they are in shale. And so you've got supply constraints and a supply roll-off that will be very hard to fill with shale oil. So net-net, over the next 3 to 5 years, it's our view that oil demand will continue to grow relative to supply and that you'll be, that there will be some degree of shortage and likely equilibrium prices are more in the $65 spot area. But then you have, of course, on the demand side, a whole other thing, that if you model out the potential shift towards electric vehicles and all of that, while over the next 3 to 5 years, very modest thing, it's actually by far the most important question 20 years from now. And so we've done modeling of what that supply-demand balance will look like if countries like India and China hit their stated policies, if they hit half of their stated policies, and in those types of worlds of a significant shift towards electric vehicles, you obviously have a much different equation if you go out further. So when thinking about oil prices and oil assets, the time frames are really important in terms of understanding where there'll be big supply-demand gaps and how those things play out. So then, just coming back.
Question, is there a cycle, I'm looking at the top right, is there a cycle time when they, is it consistent 5 years, 2 years, the supply and demand swap between supply, undersupply?
It depends on the commodity. And so the answer to that question is, historically, there was some consistency with it because the length of the projects and the payoff of the projects were so long. So you would have, 15-year booms lead to, 5-year collapses in capex that then led to the longer periods again. And now that cycle, logically, is shortening significantly. And that's to be the major issue. As long as shale is capable of producing the marginal oil, that will be short. But if the productivity in shale doesn't continue to enhance at the rate it's been enhancing, there won't be enough oil to play that swing, and you'll have a longer-term divergence.
So, leading us to this important point, and, you know, I couldn't help but listen a lot when you're thinking about your peers in the last 10 years, and that's the kind of thing that makes us nervous anyway, is that what you see over periods of time is most institutions move towards the policy portfolios of the people that have done the best. Doing the best is not the same thing as best constructed. And so that creates a certain cycle in markets that everybody sort of converges on. Whoever did the best over the last 10 years policy portfolio, which always tends to be the worst policy portfolio for the next 10 years of the alternatives. So if you just take the last, this is the last 8 years, but just make the point that this is an extremely rare circumstance. What happened over the last 8 years, to expect what happened over the last 8 years to continue for the next 10 years would be largely implausible. The red line is the historical return of a traditional US 60-40 portfolio. So the more that you are in equities, the more you're in private equity, the more you had an extreme positive result. That was, this red line is relative to every 8 year period in history. So you've got one of the top four results in every 8 year period going back to 1925. So that's a very extreme. The last 8 years are an extreme event, that the odds that you would have the repeat of that, and clearly if you took the periods that had those best periods, the subsequent decade was generally the mirror image of the decade that created that prior extreme event in terms of the performance of a portfolio. This kind of shows why, that as asset prices go up, as private equity has done well, the expected returns go down. So it's the kind of the reverse of that feeling, that that these blue lines are the rolling eight-year returns of a traditional 60-40 portfolio. And the red lines are the expected forward returns. So when you have the highest returns in the backward-looking mirror, you have the lowest, based on the pricing of the assets, the lowest forward-looking returns. So here in 2000, have had great returns and really low forward expected returns. Similarly, in 2008, in reverse, where really low returns and really high, essentially expected returns based on the asset pricing. And here we are today with extremely high, if you look at this history, backward-looking returns and near-record lows forward expected returns for a traditional portfolio, because the high prices mean low yields, and the low yields mean low future returns. So that sets us up for what markets are pricing now. And I think the biggest thing to know is that everybody's extrapolating what has happened. So what's priced into markets is what has happened for the last 8 years, that things will basically be okay, inflation will be low, so if we start here, there's very little, this is the next 5 years of discounted tightening by central banks, there's very little expectation that central banks will change policy, or that chart. Real earnings growth will be, by and large, not very strong, priced in markets with big difference, though, with the U.S. expected to continue to outperform in terms of the pricing of the market. That means it's got to outperform by even more to actually outperform in price terms. Inflation in all the major countries is priced to be, just as it has been, very calm and not a problem. And credit risks are priced to be extremely low. So the markets are pricing in a very benign scenario, which, back to Britt's point, is that's a concern. Is when the markets are pricing in a very benign scenario, there's no cushion for a bad event. And similarly, in markets pricing of volatility, we're at extreme historic lows in terms of the expectation that things could go badly, that in terms of volatility. So everybody's expecting, you know, conditions to stay as they've been with a very narrow range around that. So that's a sort of dangerous setup in the markets, even though the fact that there's a tremendous amount of liquidity or whatever is why that's getting priced, and that's real, but that's setting up that condition. And then getting to one of the challenges for your institution is that there's no secret place to hide. Everything is getting the benefit of that liquidity. So if you took the private equity as an example, where there's been this massive set, every board meeting we're in, everybody's looking at the same sort of chart and saying, oh, well, if we had more private equity, we would have been closer to the top of our peers, and so we need more private equity. But what's happened is the benefit, private equity outperformed, if you look at the history, you go back to 2003, normally private equity PEs relative to comparable companies are about half. And what's happening now is these are the PE relative, is that they moved up, if you go back a few years, because of the massive liquidity and the desire to go out on the risk curve, the PEs on private equity relative to real equity, relative to public equity was trading at a 15% premium. People were paying money to be in illiquid assets, would be, by and large, our view on that. Now, that's eased off a little bit. Public markets have caught up to some degree. But right now, private equity valuations and public equity valuations, in our view, are about the same. And so the only way to make money in public markets is not the liquidity discount that normally over long terms of history you generally trade at lower prices, but is the benefits that come either because you can create some alpha or you're utilizing leverage in some way you wouldn't be able to in other forms. But that's an important point in the environment, that so much money has flowed into illiquid assets that the prices of illiquid assets are essentially the same as liquid assets. And when you look at IPOs in the U.S., you see this, so few companies. Normally in a big equity boom, you would see a massive amount of IPOs. Mm-hmm. But you don't, and the basic reason is, as a company, you get more money, there's more money available at a better price in many cases than in the private markets, and then sort of making that really clear to the private market investors by going public is particularly risky. So what you're seeing is a strong desire to stay private relative to the normal incentive to go public to get a higher price, and that's a big part of that is the pricing. There's other things too. So
that and the secondary markets are booming.
Secondary markets are booming, exactly.
You know, if you've got time frames on your contracts with your PEs and stuff, they can find liquidity because of the secondary. So there's no artificial pressure to end the fund.
That's right.
The average age of venture funds today is still 13 or 14 years, even though they're 10 years.
So the secondary market doesn't force them as much, and there's regulation benefits. So there's a variety of reasons, but normally the fastest
secondary market is very new as well. I mean, the ability to use the secondary market in this size, which is huge.
Which comes to probably the biggest thing strategically to think about this current environment is it allows you a lot of flexibility to make any changes you want, just the things that you're saying, that this period, and this period will not last, the massive liquidity, you got, whatever you decide on your, if you're going to make strategic changes, you want to make them when you can, not when you have to. And that the current market pricing, the liquidity, the fact that all the spreads are tight, that you could basically change your portfolio any way you wanted to at a very low cost today, which won't always be the case. So you're facing extremely liquid markets and extreme ability to be flexible, that to the extent you come to the conclusion that there's something different that you want to do strategically, it's an excellent time to start implementing, which it won't always be. Another point to know. So, which comes to, what are your long-term expectations? So I think it's important to know that we're passing through an inflection point on asset returns. That if you go back since the financial crisis, excellent asset returns have stimulated the economy because, and they've been part of why you've had the rebound. It's a self-reinforcing cycle. The higher prices lead to better confidence and better demand. The better demand leads to better earnings. The better earnings lead to better prices, and you're in that part of the cycle. But that goes on for a certain point, certain extent, and then the yield problem, which is slower to manifest, which is rather than through, if you're earning, you're earning on assets through yields as opposed to price changes. As Britt said, the PEs have moved a tremendous amount since the financial crisis. There's a limit to how much PEs can change. Then the wealth on, if PEs don't change, the income on wealth is just the yield. And the yields are low. And so that's the issue. And so when you go look at what likely will be
the expected subsequent 10-year return of a 60-40 portfolio, and I'll break this down by assets later, but it's probably about 3%, a U.S.-based 60-40 portfolio.
Is that a is that nominal or real?
This is nominal returns.
Okay.
So that is quite a big thing to deal with, and as I said before, it creates, this is why there's an inflection point, is if you actually have returns of that nature, they have a negative set of consequences because people won't be able to achieve their goals with that sets of returns. And at the same time, it's also important to know that through quantitative easing and pushing up the prices, that we have this measure called developed world monetary gas in the tank. And that is how much fuel the central banks have. Their fuel is either they can lower interest rates or they could use quantitative easing to drive up asset prices. But you can only drive up asset prices until the returns are like cash. So both have limits. And we're near the extreme limits on central banking that that have ever been faced. Like the amount of fuel that's in the tank is very low if they needed it. So the future is going to be very different than the past, probably most obvious in bonds, but this is true across asset prices, which is last 30 years, U.S. Treasuries have returned 7.2% nominal. The next 10 years, they'll are estimate would be something like 2.5% would be the expected return. Euroland, 8.4% over the last 30, 0.3% over the next 10. So you've got massively different bonds. And because all assets price off of each other, that's also in the equity pricing. So last 30 years of 9.8% in equities, in U.S. equities, probably more like 2.7 in nominal returns in equities in the U.S., maybe 3.6 in Europe, 3.2 in Japan, but all very low relative to history. And still not that different. So if you took the difference between bonds and equities, 0.3 in Euroland, 3.6, so 3.5% better performance of equities than bonds would be a normal, maybe a little high, risk premium on equities relative to bonds. But the total returns are the important point I'm trying to land here, which are going to be very low. And similarly, real growth rates, because of the demographics and the debt, the growth rates, 2.5% in the U.S., 1.8 in Europe, 1.6 in Japan, that if you just look at the labor force growth and the productivity and the debt conditions, the likelihood is we're going to have growth rates more like these numbers, 1.4 in the U.S., 0.8 in Europe, 0.9 in Japan, 1.6 in the U.K., rather than the numbers that we've all sort of been used to. And nominal growth rates along those lines on the right. So much lower asset returns along with much lower growth rates would be what's the most likely scenario.
Okay, why don't you comment on it?
Yep.
Emerging markets.
Yeah.
The one thing, one line item you didn't hit was emerging markets.
Yeah, well, so emerging markets, the first point would be that by and large, risk premiums, in our view anyway, look more normal in emerging markets than in developed markets. Less squeeze, the liquidity hasn't flown as much to emerging markets. So these returns, although I just caution you, these are nominal returns that we're talking about here in local currency. So the 8.6 equities and the 4.5 real growth and the 7.5 nominal growth are in local, well, these two are local numbers. But overall, the risk premium in emerging markets, in our view, is closer to normal than it is in the developed world. And so from a sort of alpha perspective, would think having a bit of a larger position in emerging markets makes sense. Over time, you'll expect those to equilibrate through pricing, and that from a secular perspective, they'll be somewhat in line. But that is right, that's a different picture.
In the world of cash seeks returns, though, that means that these markets are going to be, there'll be a flood of cash there, right?
Yep, and you're seeing that. That started, we think there's more likelihood you'll see more of that the cash flood into emerging markets has really been the last, let's say, 12 to 15 months, where the cash flood into everything else has been the last 8 to 10 years. So that can be extended and is still in the early part, but that is what, you know, eventually those things will equilibrate as a function of that, and we could easily be wrong, so that's also part of it. But that that's the way that it'll equilibrate over time. And because these are so much bigger, the equilibration will largely draw this in, that the whole world, I would expect 3 years when we look at it, will look more like the developed world in terms of the expected returns as liquidity seeks and closes out all the last opportunities.
Page 21, so now, so you've got those low returns, and actually let me go back, low returns and low volatility into, skip ahead and come back here. Into a wide range of outcomes. So I moved ahead to 22 there. That, as I talked about, there's these two major forces you've taken since 1980. We've been in what we consider one big monetary supercycle. That you've had global deflationary forces from the increase in major increase in labor supply, for a huge increase in women entering the labor force, and then in globalization of the labor force. That's created a massive disinflationary pressure since the 1980s that would have lowered the average worker's income if not for offset by leverage. By lower interest rates created higher leverage. Each cycle had more leverage than the cycle before. And each time they had to cut interest rates more than they had to raise them to slow down the economy. So you have this one major cycle of disinflationary that was offset by lower interest rates. And then when interest rates hit zero, when that game came to an end, the offset was the printing of money, which has created this flat period of essentially deleveraging pressures on the one hand and liquidity offsetting it on the other. And as I said, we think that extrapolating that that will work into the future is a pretty big, that is a pretty big overconfident view. Like, we think there's a decent chance it'll break one way or the other, and just as big examples, we think that the developed world, there's a lot of reasons to believe a Japan-like deleveraging. If there's no major policy change, that much of the path that the U.S. and Europe has been on has already been tread by Japan, that the demographic debt problems, they're about a decade ahead of us, have been through this, have dealt with a lot of these issues, and have the major deflationary pressures that they faced for those periods of time, have had the problem of being of having unfulfilled promises and having to deal with those. And that notion that we are still on that course, and you can see that in the sense that even at a 4% unemployment rate, we only have 2% inflation. Like, what's the inflation rate going to be in the next recession? Cyclically adjusted, you have much lower inflation than we've faced at any point in these cycles. So this is one real force, one possibility, particularly if policy is handcuffed and we just kind of let things continue on. That's a real risk. And on the other hand, while it looks less likely now, but the policies along having a very easy central bank and having trade barriers and those things are an inflationary populism and higher government debt as an example. And inflationary populism is also a potential break. So preparing a portfolio for this wide range of unknown outcomes would be our goal, because we think most portfolios are built around what's done well in the last 30 years. Everybody's experienced that. They're built around what will do, what has done well. But if you took a Japan-like deleveraging or a, let's say, a inflationary but lower growth environment, most portfolios, including, I would say, Timco's, are not prepared for those. And when you add on the other danger of an inflationary type of thing and being too comfortable with a portfolio where the inflationary protection is largely energy-based, obviously, importantly, in the energy state, inflation low energy lagging that inflation would be a particularly bad set of circumstances. Prepared for. So, as we see this around the world, the secular shift towards populism, what happened in populist movements before, and what that means, what you generally see are big increases in capital controls across most examples of populism. On the right, valuation, and then a mix in private assets. So considering that range of outcomes is relevant, particularly globally, it really raises the need for, in our view, geographical diversification. And the other point we make, if you believe in that sort of the pressures are such that populism could continue to raise, is that it has a mix on equities. Sometimes populist regimes have been really good for equity markets because generally more government spending and easier central banking can be good for equities as an asset class. In some extreme cases, obviously, it's been unbelievably bad. the thing that's been consistent across all of them is gold versus the currency has been attractive in the whole history of populism. So anyway, just interesting and relevant point. And, you know, just make the point, I won't spend too much time on it, that with very low, people are pricing in very low volatility, and underlying that, though, a tremendous amount of economic policy uncertainty, investors have never had such low gold allocations relative to their portfolios. And governments have never had such low gold allocations. And gold, the good thing about gold, in the case particularly of the government, the major pools of money in the world that are controlled by governments, is the way to get in a geopolitical problem to not have your asset be a liability of some other government. So we do think that the secular environment for gold is an important part of the portfolio, particularly if you take that type of risk seriously. So, and then I'll wrap up here with just how would you approach investing. So I think just our basic breakdown of how we approach investing is just really thinking hard about the three sources of returns and doing the best you can on the ones you have under your control. So you took the total return of the portfolio historically. You would take the amount that you got in the risk-free rate, which over, like, as I say, over the last 30 years would be something like 6 or 7% return from the risk-free rate. Today, you're going to get 1. That means all else equal, the returns are 5% lower than they have been historically. Then you put on top of that beta assets that add risk relative to cash. And what we would say about that is just generally expected returns are low but positive relative to cash. And risks are rising at a time when the ability to stimulate and the pricing of risks are very low. So you've got trouble with beta, and most important thing we should say is diversify it really well. And then the second part is then how much alpha can you add on top of that? Of course, the challenge with alpha is it's difficult and zero-sum and limited, but it has the potential to be uncorrelated. So splitting it in terms of cash, beta, and alpha is really important in terms of how we would approach your problem. And then, given our circumstances, you basically have three choices. You can accept the lower returns. Keep the portfolio you currently have, you're probably going to have significantly lower returns than you've had. You can take more risk, which is what unfortunately makes us nervous. A lot of people are just moving out of the risk curve, building less efficient portfolios, less liquid portfolios with just more risk in them. Or you could try to take risk more efficiently, which we think you guys have a lot of opportunity to do that, by designing your beta portfolio in a way that creates more balance to the wide range of possible scenarios and potentially sourcing alpha in a way that really focuses on lack of correlation to the records for the portfolio. Those are two levers that could improve the portfolio construction and allow you to take risk more efficiently. And then finally, when you take our thoughts on managing money in an environment of exceptional uncertainty, and I'll wrap up here and take any questions, but our main goal would be to diversify your beta and alpha more to that range of events. So rather than, let's say, focusing on pure risk, at least our advice would be to focus on, are you guys diversified across a wide range of stress tests to achieve your goals? That would be much more where if we're saying, okay, is it the best portfolio you could have? The most important thing is that you guys achieve your goals to fund the institutions you're funding, and whether you lag or exceed your peers would be way down on the list relative to the goal of funding the institutions really well over a wide range of scenarios. And so if things are great and you're a little bit worse off than some of your peers, but you can fund the institution great. On the other hand, when you most need it is when things are bad. And can you continue to be rock solid for the institution in those things? So that would be a huge goal. And the other thing we would say is liquidity, particularly in today's environment, is being given up way too easily. And when the reason you need liquidity is because, particularly if you think the world can change relatively quickly, is that you'll be able to change your mind when you want to, when you can. And when you look at the policies in the world, the notion that the global financial system could change relatively quickly, giving up liquidity for very little return could be potentially a big mistake. And we're seeing a lot of people doing that. And then
And then finally, knowing the linkages and having a game plan, like rather than necessarily doing anything today, having a game plan for a variety of different events that you guys might transpire and preparing those beforehand so that you're working through them with a plan rather than reacting to events and try to come up with a plan on the fly. Those would be kind of the main things that we'd be working with clients like yours on achieving. So that's...
Thank you very much. Great, great presentation. Any questions for Greg?
I have one. That $65 oil you spoke of, when's that going to happen?
Hey, they wrote that down, Greg, I guarantee you.
Well, I think it's... So the first point is, as a... If I step back and say, those sort of, I'll try to answer that question with the knowledge that, you know, we're right generally on our views about 55% of the time. So there's more, it's a very high chance that I'll be wrong about what I'm about to tell you. So I just want to make sure that's clear. And then the second thing is, from the whole situation, I think like what Britt raised, and I would be in considering your portfolio, you guys clearly have a lot of oil in both energy relative to peers, and I think relative to a good portfolio construction, particularly when you add both pieces together, which I think it makes a ton of sense that if you take what you want to do is achieve your goals. And if oil's booming, probably this area in many different ways, you're going to be able to achieve the goals. And if oil's a bust, that's really a scenario where you want to be particularly prepared for this institution to be strong because you'll be needed so much more than in any other circumstance. So therefore, I make anything nervous that would lead to you know, taking on the wrong risk when any alpha position in oil is not all that likely to be right. But I do think you're starting to see it, and you will see over the next 18 months that demand is growing at a rapid rate. When you look at emerging market growth and where oil is being demanded and the nature of those things, that demand's going to be outstripping supply for a while. Since there are large inventories, the price effect of that could be modest for a while. But over time, as those inventories are drawn down, and I would say over the next 18 months, you're, you know, reasonably likely to see this, that the inventories are drawn down, the recognition that OPEC's going to have to change, reverse their policies become clear. The fact that they can reverse their policies will also cushion the price to some degree. But I think you'll see that pressure emerge over the next 18 months and could lead to a significant overshoot for what it's worth. Could lead to a significant overshoot. It doesn't need to, but it could.
What's the allocation to gold in the Bridgewater portfolios?
So if you separate, as Bridgewater thinks about the world, really is designed this way, which is that we have a beta portfolio where we say, you just forget alpha. You just said, what's the best way to take risk premiums in different assets and put them together? In that portfolio, you know, that essentially gold would be about 7% of that portfolio. Alpha, it's much more in a point-in-time pressure situation, and so sometimes it will be more long gold or could even be short gold, depending on the point-in-time pressures on gold. So that's a more variable allocation. Today, and because our alpha is diversified across a lot of different regions, our alpha position in gold is bullish, modestly bullish, but it's a bullish position in gold. And because it's a particularly good diversifier to the rest of the portfolio of alpha positions we have, that position is extended a little more than even just our view on gold. And so we have a very diversified portfolio, but gold has a modest component of that diversified portfolio from an alpha perspective. But that's more of a timing thing. From a strategic perspective, we would say there is no that asset has a diversification component that almost nothing else can do.
Do you hold cash?
Well, definitely we keep everything liquid and hold enough cash to meet liquidity requirements. But to your point here, the amount of risk you take or the cash, that the problem in the world, I think you're asking about the potential to hold cash is the central banks are doing everything they can to make it extremely painful to hold cash. And generally speaking, because the central banks, that's the one thing they can achieve, they can make it painful to hold cash, that central banks will and this was to Britt's point, that you could have 3-year sort of cycles where beta does poorly relative to cash, but very hard, as long as the central banks are in control, to do worse than cash for extended periods of time, because they can just generate. And they normally will, because if there's a bad performance of financial assets, it flows to the economy, and they'll lower interest rates or print money until it's not good to have cash. So cash is very dangerous, particularly for an institution like this, where you're trying to meet future obligations, not really current obligations. Cash is great for current obligations, but for future obligations, it's potentially riskier than long-duration assets because of that ability of the central banks to drive the value of cash down relative to assets and their desire to do so when assets do poorly.
Ask one quick question. On page 7, you have the percentage of the world growing above potential is kind of significantly higher in your one-year projections. And say, so the bottom two charts have your kind of projections looking a lot better, and yet the top chart you have your projected bubble growth number lower. I'm trying to understand how you square that circle.
Sure. Well, this is these are a count of the number of countries that will be growing above or below potential. This is the total global growth rate, and the dotted line is potential. So yeah. Global growth will be above potential. We would think it's going to be a little bit lower. So some of the countries that are growing the fastest right now, we expect to slow down, and some of the larger countries to slow down. That's how those things square, is this is the aggregate of the economy. But they're going to slow down to levels that are still above potential. So anyway, that's the reason.
One of your prescriptions is to take risk more efficiently. Maybe you could flesh that out a little bit. Is that essentially a risk parity approach, or is there more to it as far as options that the board might have?
Yeah, well, we started All Weather in 1996, and more recently there's been a risk parity industry, so I can't speak for the whole industry of risk parity, which are doing a lot of things that we wouldn't necessarily do, but the idea of making sure your portfolio is designed to achieve your goals, thinking through the fundamental understanding of the assets and creating appropriate balance to achieve your goals in the widest range of circumstances. There's too much, maybe in our view, focus on maybe having the best return in any given circumstance. The world will play out some way, and so over the last 10 years, the best returning portfolios, in our view, were designed in a way that wouldn't make that true for the next 10 years. So too much focus on return in any given set of conditions rather than return across a wide range of possible worlds. And so that's what we would do. And for us, our version, All Weather, or whatever, is our best thoughts on how to achieve that. But forget our view on that, mainly as an organization doing the work to stress test your portfolio across a wide range of potential worlds and pick outcomes in all of them that are acceptable. That would be kind of the focus of the work. I think we've done some of that with your staff, but would be happy to do. And have
so this is probably a little bit beyond most people at this table, so let me just kind of simplify risk parity for you. So risk parity is basically constructing a portfolio that is agnostic to economic outcome. Like, we don't really know what's going to happen, and so we've constructed a portfolio that sort of has equal weighting on all outcomes, and they have four different outcomes, so 25% weight in each outcome. And so therefore, does not depend on any particular economic environment to generate returns. What it does depend on, though, is leverage. So it creates a basket of assets that has a lower expected real return, but with much more stability, and then levers it up. And so a more efficient portfolio, and it's worked very well. I was actually one of the first person to ever fund All Weather. That's why it's called All Weather, because bad, good, new, high, low. If you were to say the environment's going to be X, Y, or Z, it would not tell you that your portfolio is going to be good or bad necessarily, because you were equally weighted in all portfolios. So it is the fastest growing investment strategy in the world since 2000. Ray actually designed it for his own personal family wealth, and it's all beta in that category. But it's efficient in that way that it's agnostic to economic outcome. but you do have to accept probably 200% leverage, you know, or higher to get the return.
We have slightly less than that in all weather is, but it depends on this comes to what is the return target is like the degree of leverage.
Levered up to whatever the return target is.
Whatever the return target is, but the thing that's kind of I would say misstated about more leverage. It depends how you count for leverage. It's equities, the reason equities have higher returns, let's say, than bonds or than other assets is because they are inherently, while you buy a package called an equity that's not leveraged, the underlying company is levered. And the underlying, so if you buy a bank, it's much more levered than in a balanced portfolio. Portfolio would be anywhere near that, and even the S&P 500 in aggregate is more levered than the thing. It's just the package in which it's given. So if you think about the packages, so same thing with private equity or whatever, your investment might not be levered, but the actual private equity thing is levered. So there's a little bit of that. Assets as they come are, the degree of leverage in them is generally not that examined, even though underneath the package you're buying is a tremendous amount of leverage. That's why they have higher returns. They're more leveraged to economic growth one way or the other, either through literal leverage or through that. And so that's why there's higher returns, is because they have some leverage of some type. And so then to, you know, take that down in those cases and apply some to the assets that don't have that. So you're looking at assets on a more equal tilt would be the design.
And this last one, which is, because on the liquidity for the clients, let's just keep in mind that this is not an endowment that relies primarily on the donations of its alumni. You know, it relies primarily on the income, you know, the proceeds that we get from ULANCO. So the variation of our net cash flow is going to be a lot lower. Plus, our percentage of the budget of these institutions is 17%, where the percentage of the budget for Yale is probably 80 or 90%. So, you know, that's important to remember.
Yep. Yes. Okay. Good. Thank you. Any other questions? That's it. If we've got more questions, we can talk at lunch. Are you going to hang around for lunch?
Yes, I will.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Greg, very much. We'll recess briefly for lunch. And to move us along, how about 20 minutes? Let's reconvene at 12:40.
Thank you.